Under normal circumstances, they can only see galaxies about 4 or 5 billion light years away. But they found a couple, what they call gravitational lenses, which is a bunch of galaxies clustered together, produces enough gravity to warp space. And that warp space acts like a big lens, a big telescopic lens. And it magnifies what's behind it several more times. So by pointing the Webb telescope at this gravitational lens, they can see billions of more light years in the distance than they could have normally. And the fascinating thing is Einstein predicted this gravitational lens, that we would find one.
Well, he also predicted that out of that gravitational lens, we would hear the hum of the sound of God that holds everything together, which they're discovering.
Well, the gravitational, talking about the gravitational waves there, and they're pretty much everywhere, and they're very hard to detect. I think they detect it through instruments in Antarctica or something that they have to...
Well, there are a lot of nations working on it.
Yeah, but they're very, very hard to detect, and they finally did prove that they actually exist. But yeah, this gravitational lens enabled us to see some galaxies that are about 13.5 billion light years away, just a couple hundred million years after the supposed Big Bang. And what they found is these galaxies contain stars that are older than the universe is supposed to be, billions of years older.
How can they figure that out?
By the colors in them.
Colors?
They analyze the light, and the different elements give off different colors. And the newer stars have a different composition of elements than the older stars. The newer stars just are composed of helium and hydrogen. And the older stars, like ours, has pretty much all the elements in it. You know, our star is over 4 billion years old, and it's a second-generation star. The first-generation stars are composed of they're very gaseous, composed of hydrogen and helium. And they're very giant. Like Betelgeuse is a very giant star, but it's composed of really light elements. But these really big, giant stars have put out thousands of times more heat and light than our sun. They're all young, and they live just a short period of time compared to our sun. Now, the ones with the heavier elements, they live a lot longer. Our sun is over 4 billion years old, and it'll live, I don't know, another 6 or 7 billion years before it dies. Now, the smaller ones, the red dwarfs, they'll live maybe 100 billion years. So they can live a really long time because they burn really slow. But the first generation suns, they only live less than a billion years, maybe like 400 million years or something like that. Then they just blow up. When they blow up, then that explosion creates heavier elements. Then the heavier elements gather together, and they produce the second generation of stars, of which our star is a second generation star, which is interesting that the Tibetan says this is our second solar system, that our solar system is its second incarnation, which goes along with science, which I don't know if that science was even there when the Tibetan wrote that. So our sun is a second generation, then it will eventually blow up and it will create a third generation star by everything recombining back together.
The heavier elements.
And then what happens and how the universe will end, science doesn't have much of an idea. Some think it'll just keep expanding and dissipate and just go out of existence. All the lights will just go out and we'll just have a bunch of dead matter floating around. Others think something will happen to make the matter reaccumulate and focus again in a center and create another big bang. So
I think it's like a big donut. It goes out to the outside and then it comes back to the middle.
Yeah, that's probably the most logical. Most scientists kind of lean in that direction. But they don't know what kind of force would gather all the elements back to a center.
Gravity.
Yeah, but gravity isn't strong enough right now because everything is going out. So they think something would have to change to pull everything back. Of course, they don't take into consideration that there is a creative mind in the universe that can make decisions as to what kind of forces are in play. So anyway, that's a little bit different subject, but it's an interesting subject to consider. So anyway, they've pretty much concluded that, matter of fact, some scientists are thinking that maybe the universe just is eternal. And others are thinking the universe is maybe twice as old as they suspected. And they think that maybe some of the data they've had in the past was an illusion, was created by an illusion. For instance, the redshift. As light moves a long distance, it creates what they call a redshift, and they can tell how far away the light is by how far into the red spectrum the light is, because the light actually changes with distance. And so they think, well, maybe light gets tired after billions of years, and maybe it's altered naturally, so, and maybe everything is older or farther away than we think it is, or maybe closer than we think it is.
A lot of these things are described by human concept, like beginning, the idea of beginning and end as a human concept, that based on the fact that we see all matter,
yeah,
begins and ends.
So anyway, getting back to the Course in Miracles, they think that both sides, it's like teachings like Alice A. Bailey appeal to people that are fairly mental developed and logical, and a Course in Miracles kind of appeals to the traditional religious person that's maybe looking a little bit outside the box. It's kind of like the feeling people versus the thinking people.
Can you please get back to the guilt, to the subject of guilt, because we are in a dream, but this dream will go on for billions of years into the future. So there is this karma and all this stuff. And how do you deal with it without guilt?
Yeah. Well, this is a big difference between the two, is the esoteric people deal with karma and effects within the dream itself. And now they believe that we are an illusion. Almost all the Eastern teachings, Buddhism and Theosophy, all teach we're in a dream. But within this dream, it deals with the cause and effect in the dream itself. Now, the Course in Miracles recognizes we're in a dream, but it sees the dream as so unreal that it's not worth dealing with. That the only thing of importance is just waking up, you know. Whereas the esoteric people realize, you know, we're not going to wake up for hundreds of lifetimes, so we have to make the best of it while we're here and progress from A to B to C. Whereas in Course in Miracles, it kind of presents the idea that, you know, waking up is just easy as falling off a cliff if you do what's right. As a matter of fact, one of the statements in it is, I need do nothing. But
so they don't take responsibility for their deeds.
Yeah, then it reflects back about dealing with the world somewhat and gives practical advice, but then in other parts it acts like this world isn't worth messing with. might as well just wake up and go back to your source where you're going to be happy for all eternity. And
that's not reality. Why would Jesus write that?
Why would what?
Yeah. Why would Jesus write that?
Write that? Well, I guess because he thinks it's the truth, whoever wrote it.
that might not be Jesus.
Yeah, it goes back to the parable of the prodigal son. The prodigal son, actually, the prodigal son goes through maybe 1,000 lifetimes, you know, before he finally is eating with the hogs, so to speak, and he thinks, man, there's got to be something better than this. If I can return to my father's house and just be a servant, I'll be in a lot better shape than this. So he rises and he decides to return. So that's where we're all at. We're kind of bored with everything here in this earth life. So we think we rise up and we say, okay, let's return to the Father's house. And if we can just be there and be an inhabitant and a servant, and it will be wonderful. We do that. But then when we do return, we find, oh, you're not a servant. You're a son. You're a son that has all that the Father has is yours. He wants to share everything. And when you do return, it says the Father is there waiting and sees his son afar off before he even arrives, and he goes out to greet him. And the Father is happy to see him, which kind of surprises the son, because the son thinks the Father is going to have displeasure over everything a son has done. Okay, instead the Father just welcomes him back, and he says, this is what it'll be when we finally make our return. God will just embrace us and be really happy that we've made that decision. It's kind of interesting way of looking at it.